Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. And let me see what spring is like on a Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand.
Dr. Craig, there's an article on the Huffington Post on Victor Stinger, who you have debated from time to time, and it's an interview of him from a forthcoming book. I'll just tell you, the interviewer is not very neutral on this particular thing, but he does address some questions about science and religion that we thought that we'd look at, and he also mentions you. And what have you had, two debates with him?
Yes, we had a debate at the University of Hawaii several years ago, and then more recently at University in Oregon.
He is a physicist with his PhD and had a bestseller there, God and the Folly of Faith.
He's been writing quite a number of popular level books for the free thought community since retiring.
When asked in this interview, what is the fundamental conflict between science and religion? Is it one that will never be resolved? He says that science and religion have, quote, opposing views on what constitutes reality. He goes on to say the religious believe that we have an inner faculty of some sort that enables us to learn about the world, the universe, and reality without what amounts to empirical observations. It's hard to see the two ever resolving this conflict.
I don't see that there's any conflict here between science and religion. Contrary to what Vic Stinger says, science doesn't take any sort of metaphysical view about what constitutes reality. Science is a human project to explore the natural world and to seek natural causes for the events occurring there. But it says absolutely nothing at all about whether or not, for example, the ethical realm exists or the aesthetic realm exists or whether or not there are beings beyond the natural world, such as gods and angels and so forth. These are simply not within the purview of science. Science has a limited methodology and limited province, and it doesn't come into conflict with religion unless religion enters into that province and begins to make various assertions, for example, about the occurrence of miracles or something of that sort. But it's simply false that science and religion have different views on what constitutes reality. And in terms of having different faculties, again, science doesn't make any claim that science is itself the only avenue to knowledge. That would be a non-scientific claim. That would be a philosophical claim that would be self-refuting. So if science would be quite open to saying there are other avenues to truth, such as rational intuition or divine revelation or other sources of knowledge. But science is interested in exploring what we can learn about this universe through logic and observation.
The interviewer says, in one of your more recent books, The Fallacy of Fine-Tuning, is certainly a timely one based on how common that argument is currently proving to be. What is your summary on what is wrong with the fine-tuning arguments? And he says, I've said it before, the universe is not fine-tuned for us. We are fine-tuned to the universe.
Oh, I think he must not understand what fine-tuning means. Otherwise, that statement wouldn't make sense. Fine-tuning does not mean designed. Otherwise, the argument would be circular to say the best explanation of fine-tuning is design. That would be to say the best explanation of design is design. Rather, fine-tuning simply means that human life, such as we are, embodied, intelligent life, can only exist in a universe that has very, very narrowly specified parameters. The constants of nature and the arbitrary initial conditions have to be specified to an almost infinitesimal degree of accuracy in order for us to exist. So exactly when he says we are fine-tuned to the universe, that's exactly the point. How is it that the universe is characterized by this constellation of constants and quantities that allow us to exist and are such that if they were to be altered in the tiniest measure, then in fact no intelligent embodied life of any sort could exist.
Is the fine-tuning argument part of a family of design arguments?
Sure.
How are you to make distinctions?
Well, many people talk about intelligent design today with regard to biological complexity, but the fine-tuning goes right back to the very initial conditions of the universe and asks, how do you explain the fact that the initial conditions of the universe are fine-tuned for the existence of intelligent interactive life to a complexity and delicacy that is literally humanly incomprehensible? And so when Victor Stenger says that while our form of life is certainly sensitive to these parameters, such that if they were different, we wouldn't exist, he agrees with that. But he says our form of life is not the only form of life that one can imagine. When he says that, he underestimates the truly catastrophic effects of changing these parameters. If you were to fiddle with these finely tuned constants and quantities, it's not just that maybe a different life form might have evolved somewhere in the cosmos. The point is that you wouldn't even have stars. You wouldn't have planets on which life might evolve and exist. In many cases, you wouldn't even have chemistry. You wouldn't have matter, so that there could be no life forms of any sort whatsoever in a universe that didn't exhibit the fine-tuning that we're talking about.
Bill, I heard somebody argue last week that the fact that these aspects, initial constants, are so fine-tuned seems to mitigate against there being a God or intelligent designer, because if there were, then these parameters would be wider to give us more room, wiggle room, I guess.
I don't think that makes sense, because if the universe is governed by the same laws of nature, but with different values of the constants and quantities, then life couldn't exist. It would be physically impossible. So what this person would have to be talking about would be a universe that's operating according to different laws of nature. And certainly God could have made a universe that had different laws of nature, but that doesn't come into play in the fine-tuning argument. What you do in the fine-tuning argument is consider this local group of universes, so to speak, that are governed by our laws of nature, but in which the constants and quantities take different values. And what you discover is that almost all of them are life-prohibiting. There wouldn't be any intelligent interactive life in these universes, so that a randomly thrown dart at this local group of universes would have no meaningful chance of striking a life-permitting universe. And it doesn't matter what happens outside that local cluster in universes governed by different laws of nature. Nobody knows about that.
The interviewer asked Dr. Singer, two rather traditional arguments still persevere among theists today. Firstly, that something could not come from nothing. Dr. Singer says, when tackling this question in the past, I was often forced into a philosophical discussion on defining what one means by nothing. Once you define it, give it some property, then it becomes something. So I don't really know how you define nothing when you start talking philosophically. He says, the way I handle that question now, which is consistent with all existing knowledge of cosmology and physics, is that the universe is eternal. It didn't come from nothing, or something for that matter, because it always existed and it always will.
Well, here I think he's confusing a couple of arguments. The argument from contingency, which is prompted by Leibniz's question, why is there something rather than nothing, doesn't presuppose that the universe began to exist. Leibniz was very explicit that his argument is quite consistent with a universe that is eternal in the past and has always existed. And in that case, Leibniz wants to know, why does an eternal universe exist rather than nothing? And that question isn't answered by simply saying, well, the universe is eternal. The point is, it's logically contingent. It doesn't have to exist. And so Leibniz asked quite properly, why is there something? Why is there an eternal universe rather than nothing? So Stenger doesn't really come to grips with that version of the argument. Instead, what he does is he's switching to a different argument, which is the Kalam cosmological argument that says the universe cannot be infinite in the past and therefore had to have a cause since it began to exist. And what he does in that case is he simply says that the universe is infinite in the past. The universe has always existed. It's beginningless. But then he's got to come to grips with the philosophical arguments against the infinitude of the past and the scientific evidence for the finitude of the past. And to my knowledge, he hasn't done either one of those. On a side note, in terms of defining what is meant by nothing, that's very easy. It means not anything. As I've mentioned in past podcasts, the term nothing here shouldn't be attributed some sort of property in order to define it. It's a term of universal negation. It simply means not anything. So when we say that the universe was preceded by nothing, what you mean is it was not preceded by anything. And that's a perfectly philosophically coherent notion. And in fact, it is the view that is supported by contemporary cosmological evidence.
He was asked then, how can order come from disorder, which is allegedly a theistic argument on order coming from disorder? And his answer in short seems to be comparing the order and complexity that come about in the universe with crystals. You can find order in a snowflake when it crystallizes, but these are completely explicable by natural means.
Well, I agree that order can come from disorder through natural law. For example, gravitation produces order in a featureless universe as it makes matter clump into groups, and this will then form stars. Stars can form planets about them so that gravity, through clumping, can produce order from disorder. But the question is, in the case of the universe, how do you explain the fine-tuning of the universe, which isn't the result of that sort of evolutionary development, but is in the beginning as initial conditions? And then with regard to the biological arguments, you would have to show that biological complexity is comparable to something like the structure in ice when water crystallizes. Is that something that is in fact the inevitable byproduct of random mutation and natural selection? And it seems to me that that's a very controversial question that has yet to be answered.
I'm trying to dredge up from my memory some of the thoughts on how you can't compare something crystallizing and having a pattern, a crystal, and specified complexity.
That is a point that intelligent design theorists have made, is that the kind of order exhibited in a crystal isn't complexity, because it is just a repetitive pattern that is the same. And therefore, it takes very little information to specify the order in a crystal. But when you have complexity, such as we have exhibited in the biological world, then it takes an enormous amount of information in order to specify that. And so that would suggest that the analogy is quite flawed.
Well, guess who the interviewer brings up next? Dr. William Lane Craig. He brings you up here. He says, quote, "Much is made of Christian apologist William Lane Craig today, yet your debate in Hawaii seemed to set him straight on several of the arguments, in particular his first cause argument. What do you make of this challenge?" Well, I'm going to have to challenge that question first, that he set you straight.
Yeah, that wasn't my recollection of the event, to tell you the truth. And I'm glad it's on tape so that folks can watch the DVD and make up their own mind as to which side prevailed.
Okay. He says, "I've debated William Lane Craig a couple of times. I've written about his views. He's reviewed one of my books. And I've also spoken to him personally a number of times. So we've had a fair amount of interaction. He is basically a very evangelically minded Christian theologian and philosopher. He uses a lot of cosmological arguments, but they don't hold water. They are already ruled out by existing science."
I appreciate those kind words, but I submit that, in fact, the cosmological arguments I used, far from being ruled out by existing science, are supported by existing science. In our debate at the University of Hawaii, it was Stenger who had to appeal to a model of the universe, which is not part of existing science, but was a, I think, self-contradictory model of time before time, where he interpreted events occurring before the Big Bang as another arrow of time, which in order to be before the Big Bang would have to be both earlier than the Big Bang and yet also later in time than the Big Bang. In fact, what he was really describing was a universe in which you have two arrows of time that both have a common origin at the Big Bang, and therefore doesn't escape the origin of the universe after all. So I think the existing science supports the view that I've defended very well.
Now, I just made a connection, Bill. In this interview, I've wondered where this phrase comes from. Science flies you to the moon. Religion flies you into buildings. Reference to 9/11. I didn't know that Stinger said that or wrote that, but he did. And he sent it to Richard Dawkins when Dawkins was trying to come up with slogans to go on the sides of buses in that atheist bus campaign. He liked it and said it was the best one he received. A lot of people have picked up on it, so it's worked out pretty well. It's one of those sound bites which people have made use of.
Yes. Science it's a flies great you. Sound bite.
Yeah.
I think. I mean, it really it conveys what the atheist wants to say. But, of course, it's not the true characterization of religion. Religion also founds universities and hospitals and leper colonies and cares for the poor and builds magnificent architecture, produces the world's greatest literature. So it's a clever soundbite, but it's a misrepresentation of what religion does. You know, and you might also say, too, science invents atomic bombs and mustard gas and things of that sort. Science has been misused for evil ends, just as religion has been misused for evil ends.
The interviewer says, what do you define as what is new about the new atheism? Stinger wrote a book called The New Atheism, Taking a Stand for Science and Religion, which came out in 2009. Stinger says, I took a lot of flack from old-time atheists who resented all the work they had done promoting atheism, secularism, humanism that was not fully recognized. But there was a difference. When starting in 2006, a whole series of bestsellers appeared by Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Christopher Hitchens, and myself. These all got a lot of attention. In the new atheism, I was focusing on those works and asking what it was about these bestsellers that were different from the old atheism, which I did acknowledge. The difference was that we are far more uncompromising towards religion. The term accommodationist is used for people who were saying that they wanted to promote atheism, humanism, and science, but at the same time, we should respect the opinions of believers, and in particular, we shouldn't get into fights with them, since we need their support for, say, the teaching of evolution in public schools. Moderate Christians tell us that they believe in evolution, but surveys show they really don't, since they claim evolution is God-guided, which isn't Darwinian evolution. In Darwinian evolution, humanity is an accident, and that is unacceptable to Christians. They sure as heck don't want that taught in school.
Well, it's interesting that he says that the difference between the old and the new atheists is that the new atheists are more uncompromising, and they don't think that they should respect the opinions of believers, so that they advocate being disrespectful and uncompromising. I think, as I've reflected on this, the difference between the old and the new atheism is that the old atheism wanted to eliminate religion from the public square. They wanted to have a secular public square. But they were quite content to allow believers to exercise religion in their private lives. I think the difference is that the new atheists, like Dawkins and the others, want to exterminate religion, even from the private lives of society's citizens. Richard Dawkins thinks that children being taught religious beliefs or going to Catholic parochial school is a form of child abuse, and that the state, therefore, needs to step in. They want to eliminate religious belief entirely from Western society because they think its effects are so harmful. So that's where I see the difference between the old and the new atheism. Now, I want to say just as an aside, Kevin, I am always amazed when I hear these statements by scientists that misrepresent scientific theories. And here, Victor Stinger has done this again. It is no claim that Darwinian evolution is not God-guided, or that human life is an accident, as he claims. As Alvin Plantinga has, I think, explained very well in his new book, Where the Conflict Really Lies, that claim is a philosophical add-on, a metaphysical thesis that's not scientific. It's not part of the theory. What this theory says is that the mutations that occur are random in the sense that they don't occur with a view toward the benefit of the host organism in which they happen. Mutations don't occur for the benefit of the host organism. But it is no part of the theory to say that these mutations are without purpose or are not God-guided or do not occur for some reason. And obvious, it's obvious why that's the case. Science could never be in a position to make justifiably such a claim. So that is a philosophical claim, not a scientific claim. And therefore, I think it simply shows that Stenger doesn't understand Darwinian biological evolutionary theory.
Bill, I have to keep saying so much of this goes back to 9/11. I mean, that's when Sam Harris said, the days of just letting religion slide are over.
But, I am totally in sympathy with the new atheists about religion not being exempt from criticism. I am fully in agreement that anybody's religious views ought to be open to criticism and examination.
In a respectful way.
Sure. That's where I would disagree with them about we shouldn't respect the opinions of others. That's just discourtesy. That's just uncivil behavior to act like that. That's more a personal reflection of the kind of individual you are. If you think you have to treat people with disrespect because you disagree with them. But I think that we want to respectfully examine the merits and demerits of any worldview, religious or otherwise, that someone puts forward as the truth.
In other words,